I don't really know how to approach this topic other than to tell you a couple of stories that illustrate how I got myself into all of this. And what I'd like to do tonight, for the sake of our shared love of philosophy and big ideas and great ideas, the synthesis of ideas, is to tell you about some of the people who have influenced the work that I do, and what happened that brought them into the sphere of one another's influence, and what some of my thoughts are about how we have some real discoveries yet to be determined in the application of some of these ideas. There was a wonderful talk in this room back in the fall by Kevin Majors. Were people here? Well, Kevin was one of my star students at Southwestern. And no one does a better job of dismantling and reassembling Aristotle than Kevin does. He's a brilliant guy. And I'm humbled to be in the same room because when I'm around him and I'm talking with him, whether it's about ethics or metaphysics or phenomenology, I feel like a pair of old brown shoes with a shiny black tailor-made tuxedo. He's really brilliant, and I won't try to match his intellectual skill or performance tonight, but I do want to pay tribute to his thinking because it's just remarkable. Some of the people I will talk about tonight in connection with Harry Frankfurt's work are also people who have been influential in the profession that Kevin and I share, which is the field of psychiatry and human behavior. And I'm going to draw on some examples that I hope will be familiar to some of you. And I hope to stimulate your interest in the work of Harry Frankfurt. Has anyone here heard of Professor Frankfurt? How many folks really has anyone heard of Frankfurt other than with regard to his now famous essay on bullshit?
Wikipedia.
You looked him up on Wikipedia. That's good. Well, he spent a whole lifetime as an analytical philosopher and wrote brilliant essays. And then a few years ago, he wrote an essay on bullshit. That's the title. And was widely circulated on the internet. He ended up appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And that was simply wonderful. And actually, the essay is quite entertaining. It's not entirely tongue-in-cheek. And maybe some other time we can get into that notion of truth-telling versus falsehood and that sort of thing. But tonight I really want to focus on what is the heart of Professor Frankfurt's work. This is a philosopher I admire so deeply. I only hope that I'll have a chance someday to meet him and talk with him at Princeton. I discovered 2 years ago that he and I have a mutual friend, another brilliant philosophical thinker, Professor Robert George of Princeton. Robbie is actually a professor of law, but an amazing scholar who teaches a course for freshmen at Princeton. Every year or so, he comes to town with one of his colleagues, Cornell West, and gives talks here at St. Mark's and sometimes in the community. Well, anyway, back to the topic at hand. 6 years ago, I was asked to write a commentary for a journal called Philosophy, Psychiatry, and Psychology, the international journal. And the commentary was about a paper written, a long paper written by one of my colleagues from Philadelphia. I had never heard of Harry Frankfurt. And to write the commentary, I really had to read Frankfurt's work, and I was really taken. He has a little book. There are actually two, and they're on these. They're on my note pages, actually. Not that I really thought anyone tonight would want to take notes, but if you would just kind of hand those around to people. These have some references and things. You want to send those that way, please? And around the time I first read Frankfurt's book, The Importance of What We Care About, I had also been reading a bestseller by Daniel Goleman called Emotional Intelligence. Is anyone familiar with? Yeah, that's much more familiar to most of us. So, now there's time.
I asked you to turn it down. There we go.
Did I do that?
No, I asked you. It was when you raised your hand.
Yeah, I know. That was really kind of cool. I haven't had a moment like that since the 60s.
That was real.
What I want you to do is center yourself. Feel the energy in the core of your being. Relax. Relax.
You can't get it turned
on. Yeah, see, this would never happen to Kevin Majors. Oh, then yes, a Jesuit education wins every time.
There you go.
Kevin made some points that that I think are worth repeating about the work of psychotherapy. And like Kevin, because I got into psychiatry as a psychotherapist, I was really interested in what makes people tick. How is it that we become who we are? What are the forces that shape our personalities? And it's when I was doing some work in personality theory back in the 70s that I first encountered a psychologist, Jerome Frank, from Johns Hopkins, who is a brilliant man, wrote a book in the 1960s called Persuasion and Healing. And Frank was trying to put together all of the different ideas that we had about what makes people tick, how people change, what theories we have about human personality, and what we can do to alleviate suffering. And the word that he used to characterize the condition that we so often see from the perspective of the psychotherapist was demoralization. And it appeared to him, and I agree, 50 years later, that the reason folks eventually pick up the phone and call a therapist or come into a psychiatrist's office is because something in the flow of events in life has become so significant that there is a sense that things can't get better, or there is a sense of being stuck. And beyond that, that feeling of being stuck, that feeling of being unhappy, also has the feeling of demoralization. I'm not going to be able to get myself out of this. And his writing about it, and the sense of powerlessness that goes along with that state of mind, which most of us have had at one time or another in our lives, was just, his writing about that was just really brilliant. And the other thread that I want to tie together with Professor Frankfurt's work is the work that happened in the field of psychiatry in the 20th century as well. But I'm going to talk about an area that may be really unfamiliar to most of you. It's a rather obscure little corner of psychiatric history. And I hope to at least illustrate how this may be very important and worth a little more attention than we've given it. Everyone remembers that around the turn of the last century, the early 20th century, in 1900 to 1905, Sigmund Freud was developing and publishing his ideas about psychoanalysis. And there are amazing stories, some of them that read like detective novels, about all of the intrigue in the psychoanalytic movement. strangely enough, on our faculty, I'm the anti-Freud. And so I've spent most of the last 30 years reading more of the psychoanalytic literature than the vast majority of my colleagues. And I say that with modesty, simply to say that when you really think somebody has a wrong idea, you need very seriously to investigate the basis of their thinking. Well, in the process of doing this, I also became very interested in the historical perspective of all this. We were talking about Marx earlier, and the powerful influence that figures like Marx and Freud and Einstein have had on science and economics and society in general. And historically, around Freud were some really brilliant, powerful people. Who were they? They were people like Jung. I'm sure we have some Jungians here tonight. Ferenczi, Alfred Adler, whose ideas had a profound influence on American education. 8 or 10 key people. One of those people was a fellow named Otto Rock. I see some people nodding their heads. That doesn't happen to me very often. Otto Rock was an amazing fellow who actually was a professor most interested in art and literature, and of that inner circle, that Freudian inner circle, he was the only one who was not a physician. He was not an MD. He was a doctor of philosophy. And not only was he welcomed into the inner circle, he really was the individual who was closest to Sigmund Freud for the longest time. And he stuck with the master well into the 1920s. Now, where it really got interesting for me as the anti-Freud, the fellow who thought Freud really had it wrong, was that I had never really explored why other people thought Freud had it wrong. And then I read a book that's listed on your note sheet there, Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, a Pulitzer Prize winning book that came out in 1973. Like a lot of hippies in the 70s, I carried it around, but I didn't read it very seriously. Same with Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception, by the way. You know, always look good on the bookshelf if you had a date. And I was reintroduced to Becker, as so often happens, by one of my students who came in with a copy of The Denial of Death and said, have you ever read this guy? And of course I said, sure, I've read Becker one more. And Chris Cathers, his name's a wonderful psychiatrist, has a practice over here and now near Park and Central. And Chris and I spent about a year reading that book together. And that book is about Otto Rock. And it tells the story of Rock's ideas. Now, what happened then was I felt like I really had to read Otto Rock. And I don't know whether anyone here has read Rock, but that's not an easy read. The hope was, among his peers, that he would have a friend or colleague who would help him refine his prose to make it more understandable. But I plunged into the book Wheel Therapy, which is listed there. And I had quite an amazing experience, because I was reading a book written in 1935 that described the way it felt to me to practice psychotherapy in 2005. And here's the historical point I want to make. When Otto Rock looked at Freud's work and Freud's theory, and then looked at his own experience with patients in analysis in his office, he saw there was a real difference between the way it seemed to him and the way it seemed to Freud. and he described it very eloquently. It's a little difficult to read, but once you get into it, it's really sort of hard to put down if you're a psychiatrist and you've had some of these experiences. And he said that Freud's approach was pedagogical and his own approach was experiential. This is a profound distinction. He said that Freud had the belief, the mistaken belief, that explaining to people why they felt the way they felt would give them insight and then they would get well. They would be better. Thank you. It doesn't work. Sometimes it works. But not the way that Freud thought it would. What Rock was doing, I suppose, was a little bit like operating his own subterranean rebellion, because what he was discovering was that in the relationship between the patient and the therapist, the patient had experiences that essentially empowered that suffering individual to summon the courage to face life on life's terms. Eventually, in fact, being able to stand on their own two feet and say goodbye to the therapist and go out and create their own life. And Rock saw this as analogous to what happens to the artist. That is, the artist is filled with emotion and conflict and turmoil and confusion and suffering and doubt and anxiety, and somehow manages to take that energy and use it in a creative way, not to be paralyzed by the fear. And Rock said very simply, there are two great fears. The first fear we experience, and Kevin talked about this back in the fall, the first great fear we experience is our infancy, where we are helpless and vulnerable and constantly at the mercy of everything around us. And Rock called that the trauma of birth. And then we get on our own two feet, our powers of reason develop, we mature as individuals, and at some point we recognize our own mortality. And now what we are dealing with is not the immediate threat to our vulnerable infantile selves, but the actual fact of our own death. And this was the substance of Ernest Becker's denial of death, and what makes it a really good Pulitzer Prize winning read. Now, how does all this go back to Harry Frankfurt? The problem that we've had in psychiatry and psychology, aside from the fact that most of us at best are amateurs when it comes to philosophy, And very few psychiatrists and psychologists, I think, read philosophy seriously. But the real problem that we've had is that we have tended simply to adopt some of the broad notions out of philosophy. We were talking about constructivism earlier, the notion of creating your own reality, all that kind of... I call it California schmarmy. and if you talk to psychiatrists and psychologists, you get a lot of California schmarmy that is confused with serious philosophical thinking. And this is even true in very particular areas like personality theory. Harry Frankfurt back in the 60s began to ask the question, what really is the concept of the person? And I have a quotation here from him in an essay that stirred up some dust in the mid-60s called Freedom of the Will and the Concept of a Person. He said, quoting, "What philosophers have lately come to accept as analysis of the concept of a person is not actually analysis of that concept at all." And he said, "What we are avoiding in philosophy is understanding ourselves as we really are." This sounds simple on the face of it. His writing about it is elegantly simple and understandable, even for someone who, like me, who's really an amateur at this. And that impressed me greatly. And what Frankfurt did was to say this, that philosophy has two big areas. There's the area of ethics, how we should behave, and there's the area of epistemology, how we know what we know. And he said we really ought to be paying attention to a third area, and that is what he calls the importance of what we care about. And when Frankfurt looks at the concept of the person, he says that the person is not the same as other organisms. And he invokes ideas that almost all of us are familiar with and have either studied or run into or just come up with on our own. For example, something as simple as the fact that, you know, I'm not like my dog in the sense that I really do think about whether it might rain on Saturday or my car is in good enough shape to get me to Austin. In other words, I have the capability to think in time. And I have the capacity to reflect on my own thoughts and my own behavior and to synthesize possibilities about my future. Now, those are old ideas. Those are ideas that are tried and true and the subject of argument and debate from time to time. But then Frankfurt really takes this a step further and says that among human beings, not everyone, but a lot of people, are actually capable of determining what we care about. Now that, again, sounds self-evident. But he refers to this not just in terms of a vague abstraction, but very specifically in terms of human will. And he says this is the area of philosophy that is neglected. Now, he makes certain assumptions, and then I want to tie the third piece of the third historical theme together with this in a moment. He does make certain assumptions, and one of those assumptions is that human beings have a will. We experience will, that is, those of us who are self-reflective experience will, and we experience a phenomenon that is familiar to all people from time to time, which is best summed up with a simple expression: the will that I have is not the will that I want to have. And he marks these distinctions by calling them first-order volitions and second-order volitions. Now, you'll notice, if I make a distinction between the will that I have and the will that I want to have, that's not the same as the will that I ought to have. That's ethics. And it's not the same as the will that someone else thinks I should have. So there is the will I have, and then there is the will that I want to have. Frankfurt says that not everyone is capable of recognizing first order and second order volitions. And that category of human being he refers to as wanton, W-A-N-T-O-N. It's a peculiar way of characterizing it. But he says that that wantons are those individuals who cannot make distinctions about their volitions, and small children. It's in the essay. And lower order animals. So his insight, his metaphysical insight, his analytical philosophical insight is that we have first order and second order volitions. Now going beyond this, he raises the question of what we care about. Not what we ought to care about, not what we want to care about, but what we actually care about. And he says this is the fundamental characteristic of the person, what we care about. And he says what is essential in appreciating our position in life and our position in the universe generally is recognizing the importance of what we care about, that it governs what we do and how we think and how we feel. Let me talk for a minute now about that other thread that I mentioned earlier, and that's work that is very nicely described by Daniel Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence. At the beginning of that book, Goleman tells a story, a true story, well, one that I remember from the night it happened. You may recall some years ago, a train was coming from Atlanta to Dallas, I believe, and crossing Louisiana. And something happened as the train was going across one of the bayous in Louisiana, and the trestle gave way, and the train went into the water. This was one of those moments that transfixed people nationwide as CNN was covering the accident as it happened, because there were, for some reason, first responders very close by, and there were cameras and news people there very quickly. And aboard the train, there was a family, mother, a father, and a daughter. The daughter was confined to a wheelchair because of a neurological condition like spina bifida or cerebral palsy. The three of them were in one of the cars that went off the tracks and into the bayou. And just like in an action movie, the train car was slowly sinking. And people were scrambling to get out. The first responders were breaking out the windows and bringing people out of the windows of the train. And the mother and father together picked up their daughter and passed her through the window to the rescuers. And then the car sank and the mother and father drowned. I choke up every time I tell this story. And Goldman's point in using that story is to show that, as Kevin Majors mentioned last fall, the human brain is quite a complex system. And in the brain is a part of the brain, the amygdala, which is, I think, Greek for almond. It's shaped like the little nuts you get in the bags and always used to have under the tree at Christmas. It's right down in the middle. And it's something like the seat of emotion. And there are moments when in the central nervous system, the amygdala will override the frontal lobes. And the point of this is that loving their daughter so much, two human beings chose to give up their own lives or put their own lives at serious risk for the sake of what they really cared about, because of the importance of what they really cared about. Now, if you take these two areas of inquiry, you take Goleman's work in emotional intelligence and some of the amazing neuroscience that the Dalai Lama and others have done lately, that Goleman has also written about, and the understanding of the way the brain works. And you look at the logical reasoning and the metaphysical analysis of a brilliant philosopher like Harry Frankfurt, you see what happens is that the two really come together. That Frankfurt's insight, which was best summarized in the Tanner lectures he gave at Stanford. It's another little book called Taking Ourselves Seriously and Getting It Right. That reference is also on the note page. Frankfurt says, we don't love because we have reasons. We love, and that gives us reasons. And I think this is a profound, simple, and elegant insight into the nature of human nature. It's particularly brilliant considering that he wrote his first essays in the 1960s, long before we had MRIs and CAT scanners, long before we understood the subtleties of neuroscience. And in fact, when I was at Duke as a medical student, late 60s and early 70s, I remember having to fill in the blank with the arrow pointing to that little almond-shaped thing in the cross-section of the brain, and I had to know what it was called, but we didn't know what it did. There were lots of parts of the limbic system, that emotional center, the oligoencephalon, that we didn't understand back then. Well, so what's the point of all this, and what does this have to do with Otto Rank? Well, Otto Rank died young, at least from my perspective, he died young. He died in his 50s and did not quite complete his master work, and he wasn't around like some of his contemporaries to assure his own legacy. And frankly, I think he wasn't all that interested in his legacy. I think what he was interested in was taking life seriously and getting it right and trying to articulate what some of his experiences had been, helping others come to terms with their experience of paralysis by fear and their denial of their own mortality and their inability to get on with life. And the significance of this in terms of the role of philosophy, I think, is really nothing less than amazing to the psychiatrist who takes it seriously, because we're living in a time now when so much of what we are doing in the behavioral sciences is oriented around technique or method or manualization, that is, having checklists and manuals and diagnostic and statistical analyses of signs and symptoms, none of which really tell us very much about the person. Risking, therefore, as I said in the little synopsis that we published about tonight on the web, risking the fact that psychiatry at best risks becoming irrelevant to our experience as human beings, and at worst could be very dangerous. Because if you stop and think about it, if all we are doing in behavioral science is operating on individuals, then we're not doing much that's very different from what Pavlov did with his dogs when he rang the dinner bell and they would salivate. And the reason I talk about this using words like risk and danger is that I think most psychiatrists and psychologists today would say, well, you know, B.F. Skinner's ideas about behavior modification were interesting and they had their place and all this, but we're really beyond that now. I'm not so sure. I'm really not so sure. I think that we risk reducing human beings and reducing human experience to what we truly believe is the scientific and molecular explanation of things, while at the same time really not explaining much at all. I mean, I can give you a medication like Xanax or Valium, and you will relax. I can give you a stimulant like amphetamine or cocaine, and you will perk up. I can go outside and we can smoke a cigarette, and if we're anxious, the nicotine will calm us down, and if we're tired, the nicotine will pick us up. Like the old joke about the thermos bottle. You put something in it cold, it stays cold all day. You put something in it hot, it stays hot all day, but how do it know? That's what I want to know about nicotine. And the deeper question, and the reason I think that groups like this are so vital to the future of the kind of work that that we do in medicine, is that in this highly technological world and age and postmodern age, we really cannot expect every scientist, every physician, or every therapist to think about the things you think about. The things you think about, the things that bring you here. What brought me here back in the fall are in Frankfurt's phenomenology, in Ronk's analysis of human relationship and human behavior, and in Goldman's elegant work tying together the findings of neuroscience with the facts of human experience, these are the places where we'll get the right questions that get folks looking for the broader answers. I want to close with a comment, and this I should have put this reference on the list, and I didn't, but my email is on there, so I'll be glad to email it to anyone who'd like to hear it. A few years ago, I realized that if psychotherapy was going to have an alternative philosophical paradigm, it really was not going to fit very neatly into the healthcare system. And this was before health reform. That there is a real difference or a distinction between being helpful and being therapeutic. When we begin to apply the concept of therapeutic, we run into all kinds of economic considerations. You may have noticed that if you're a little too well-fed like I am, you can go to your doctor, like my wonderful internist, Mary Ellen Blunzer, and she'll give me medicine for my blood pressure. Or I can eat more sensibly and get out and exercise more and take off this extra 30 or 40 pounds. My blood pressure will normalize. So psychotherapists are sort of in a jam. There's being helpful and then there's being therapeutic. And when we start talking about being therapeutic, then we're talking about how people are going to pay to get helped. And then economic considerations arise. And this is how I ended up reading what some of the economists were saying. And I stumbled across this observation. This is from a book called The Winner's Curse by an economist named Richard Thaler. And it really summarizes a lot of what what I've tried to talk about tonight. Talking about how we make theories. The lesson is that their job in making theories is much harder than previously thought. The lesson that their job is much harder than previously thought is a depressing one for economic theorists. Writing down a model of rational behavior and turning the crank may not be enough. Sounds like psychiatry, doesn't it? And writing down a good model of less than fully rational behavior is difficult for two reasons. First, we can't build good descriptive models without collecting data, and we have a strong allergic reaction to this. Second, rational models tend to be simple and elegant with precise predictions, while behavioral models tend to be complicated and messy with much vaguer predictions. But look at it this way. Would you rather be elegant and precisely wrong, or messy and vaguely right? Now, Richard Thaler, T-H-A-L-E-R, if you want to look him up on Amazon later. It's a great read. The Winner's Curse, Paradoxes and Anomalies of Economic Life. Some of the best thinking today in behavioral science is actually being done in the field of economics. And I think there's a reason for that, because in economics you discover what William James really meant when he talked about the cash value of an idea. You know, their ability to predict is really, really has a payoff. Now, I've touched on three different areas, the Goldman stuff, the Ronk stuff, and Harry Frankfurt's remarkable work about human will. I want to come back to Frankfurt as I close, because the key in understanding and appreciating Frankfurt is understanding that he has the courage, really, to say that human will is related to the concept of love. Once again, we do not love because we have reasons. We love, and that gives us reasons, as illustrated in the example from Goldman. From this, we can begin to develop a concept of a person that embraces some of the greatness of philosophy. East and West. Tonight, I've really only talked about some of the ideas in Western philosophy, but Frankfurt is the heir to a very powerful tradition. I mean, he is a Spinoza scholar, for example. And I hope sharing these thoughts with you about where my work and my thinking has been taking me lately, I've stimulated you to take a look at Frankfurt, because he's really accessible and readable, and I think judging from the several conversations I've heard in this room over the times I've been here, you'll find it really worthwhile. Do we have time for some give and take and support? Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Yes.
Okay. What is the relationship between this focus on what we care about and that field called ontology, meaning?
Frankfurt says it's really separate in this sense that the nature of being is not really the same as the nature of being human. In the sense that philosophers usually discuss the being of being human. That didn't make any sense at all, did it? This is the wonderful thing about, this is like being up in the dorm at 2 in the morning thinking, okay, I'm sober enough now to have this conversation. What Frankfurt says we have overlooked, that is so obvious, is that human will is actually a part of the ground substance of human being, and when you begin to look at these different threads and sort of see the way they weave together to create a fabric, what we see is he's absolutely right from the standpoint of neuroscience. That is, we understand now that there are mechanisms within our physical selves that are directed by neurotransmitters and neuronal connections and highly intricate, highly organized, probably impossible to understand without some sort of incredible advance in our ability to map all this. But he says it's really wired in, that human will is really wired in. Now, he doesn't answer the question, although he asks it, he doesn't answer the question, how is it that we go haywire? How is it that people have disordered will? How is it that some individuals seem obviously incapable of recognizing that they have a will? In order to have a second order volition, to have that idea, the will that I have is not the will that I want to have, I have to appreciate that I have a will. And Frankfurt says, he refers to these individuals as wanton, and says there are, it's sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous says, there are such unfortunates who don't have that self-awareness, that capacity for self-reflection. I don't know how responsive that is to you.
Okay, I guess I'm thinking in ontology that issue focused on, say, the dialectic of, and it's really a hard love, of excellence and compassion. To me, appreciation of that could inform what you're talking about.
That's a perceptive observation. Frankfurt actually does address that, and he makes a really provocative statement about it. And Professor Frankfurt, if I ever do get to meet you, please forgive me for the extent to which I have misrepresented all of your ideas, because this is the way it reads to me. But Frankfurt says very specifically, what you care about is irrelevant. What is important is that you care about something. You can imagine how his graduate student seminars went on and on and on arguing about that. What you care about is irrelevant. The important fact is that you care about something. And it is that caring that represents the way we order the will in the first place. And you can see from that statement that he says this isn't about ethics. This isn't about good and evil.
Okay, we have a question.
We have different ways of caring about things.
And different things that we care about. And when we are unhappy, what does that reflect? It reflects conflict of our will.
We had a question.
Yes.
Calvin.
I'm trying to put this in a scenario where I think it's an amygdala. I know that the almond shakes,
yeah,
the seat of the will, awareness of your will.
It's the seat of emotion. Yeah, yeah.
But it's that the will. Specifically, emotion. What you're talking about. If, presentations, one with a normal, one with a damaged, abnormal sense of will,
uh-huh,
and that's something with a highly developed sense of will. Would there be any commonality, something I could observe from the outside that would give me a sense that this person is aware of their will,
yeah,
this person is vague about it, this person has no sense at all?
I'm working on that one. I encounter individuals who have a very difficult time clarifying for me what they really care about. Over the last few years, I've begun to ask that question, sitting in the therapist's chair. Tell me what you care about. What really matters to you? And I think there are individuals who really struggle or perhaps are incapable of answering that question authentically. That sometimes what we hear is a recitation of what the individual thinks they ought to care about. And that's not quite the same thing. Now what's the relevance of that for me as a practicing psychiatrist? It gives me a sense of what the baseline is. It tells me what our starting point is. And I think this is what happened to Otto Rank back in the 1920s. I think he was sitting there with people who were suffering, who were hurting, and he was looking for a way to spark their recovery from what was euphemistically called neurosis, neurotic conflict. And what he was looking for was that creative urge, that creative spark. If you look at amazing pieces of art that capture our attention and we look at it and we wonder about it, what we see is something that has something to do with what the artist cared about. And that was what Ronk noticed. That in life, the artist might be miserable as imaginable, and yet they were able to focus that energy on the creation of something. And the artist gives us a concrete example of the way in which all of the confusion and turmoil and angst and so forth can still result in creating something that was not there before. A metaphor for our own lives, where we are creating something that was not there before. Now the difference, the distinction is, the person who experiences that second order volition, that wanting the will, and the person who can direct that energy then can experience also the satisfaction of the completion of, or the fulfillment of, the action that goes along with the will. Does this make a certain kind of sense? And this all makes sense in terms of neuroscience. As complex as the brain is, you really get it about the mother and father saving the life of the daughter. And Frankfurt, by the way, writing many years before that ever happened, says that we can understand the fundamental nature of love simply because many of us understand what it is to love our children. He says, I love my son. He makes a good philosophical point here, by the way. I love my son, but I can't possibly explain to you why I love this kid with all the crap that he's done. And then he makes a really important observation. He says, I cannot choose not to love him. And I think when I read that statement, it just registered, because that fits with neuroscience and Goleman and everything else. When we love something or someone, when we care about something, we cannot just simply say, well, I choose not to care about that, and experience it a different way. It just doesn't happen. And that's when I think he said, this is wired in. This is fundamental to the concept of a person. And if we don't start our program of ontology from that point, then we're missing what in his elegant way of saying is the most obvious fact of all.
Question here. Okay.
Yes.
I have an interest in political attitudes and beliefs, so it seems like in the last few years, contemporaneous with your practice and study and so forth, it seems like the last 30 or 40 years or so that we've become more polarized in the country, and that people today really seem to seek out information to confirm
right
what they already think. And so I'm wondering how that relates to their ability to, you know, have they already exercised their volition a long time ago? Because it's not like they're not really open to changing or being critical. They just look for ways to confirm what they already think. And how does that relate to what we really care about?
Well, sometimes, in inauthentic fashion, we claim to care about mistreatment of animals when what we really care about is being right. Or we claim to care about equality, justice, and liberty. In fact, we were talking earlier about some of our disagreements with some of the postmodernists, most of whom I cannot possibly comprehend. But I made the statement that Michel Foucault, for example, and his attack on everything represents a kind of nihilism, where the one thing that is clear to me is that and of course, clear to me doesn't mean get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks if you've got $8.95. But it's clear to me what Michel Foucault cares about is being right about everything, all the time. And that's his starting point, and that's his end point. And if you disbelieve me, then try arguing with any of Foucault's ideas. You're wrong on the face of it, because the fact that you're arguing with him demonstrates what it is he's talking about. There is a kind of sophistry there that I've never sorted out, and it may just be my limited ability to see these things. I was saying earlier, these are the kinds of puzzles that kept me out of the really good philosophy programs.
Question back.
I had to go to medical school by process of elimination.
You learned that, so Ron saw that there's the two theories, the trauma of birth and the awareness of death, right, that caused this suffering, you might say. And are you saying that Frankfurt answered that by saying that having something to care about can alleviate those fears?
That's nicely said. See, what just lit up my intellectual life was that I had this experience that Ronk writes about. I mean, I'd been there. This was like reading my own diary, and it was written 15 years before I was born. I've had the experience Ronk describes, the experience of being with another person and engaging, not at a pedagogical level, but at an experiential level in a relationship. I've had that experience with people I love. What lit up my intellectual life was the fact that here was an analytical philosopher, brilliant in ways that I can't possibly imagine, saying in plain language that I can understand how it was that I was having this experience, which was the experience Otto Ronk wrote about as well. I mean, when you really boil it down, I remember one of my great teachers at the University of Wisconsin during my residency said, you know, John, any patient worth taking care of is worth loving. And I never really got it, what Carl Whitaker meant when he said that, until years later. I mean, I got it in a sense of, that's noble, that's great. But it's beyond that. That it is that caring, that willingness to be with, that can make all the difference. Is that responsive to? Because what you said was good.
Yeah, okay, second follow-up.
Yeah,
quick follow-up.
Okay. How does it actually alleviate the fear of death?
It doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't. And this is where you'll really enjoy Becker. Have you seen that book? You'll like it. It's a great read. And he says that if you've read Camus, it's sort of like Camus, but with a happy ending. You know, when I get really depressed, I can look at my Amazon.com and I've ordered 4 more copies of L'Étranger and and I'm reading The Myth of Sisyphus again, and then my dear wife here will say, it's time to get back on the Prozac, you know. Because Becker with Ronk says that this is where myth and symbol and all that wonderful Joseph Campbell stuff that my good friend Doug Geiling can tell you so much about really begins to make sense, that's why we have the great creative works that we have, that in the face of the inevitability of our own death, we have the courage to create. We don't quit. Frankfurt says in his Tanner lectures from Stanford, that the little book, that something we overlook is we love being alive. We don't even notice that. We love being alive. Part of it is it's wired in. If you fall in the pool, the first thing you do is you try to get back to the surface so you can breathe. Now, there are people who are disordered and sick and who go another direction. And Frankfurt very carefully says he's not talking about the person who has such disordered biology that they, for all kinds of things, reasons we don't understand, choose not to be alive. But the fact is about human beings, the fact is that we love life, we love being alive. And we are organized around preserving that, unless a second order volition intervenes so that we care about something even more than that. See how that all fits? Does that make sense?
We have some more questions.
Yeah.
This gentleman here in the back.
I wonder if there's any way that you could elaborate with even a hypothetical example or something on first and second order volition, because I've been chewing on it, and you've already eliminated that it's not a matter of an individual simply thinking they should have a certain volition, because that programming can come from anywhere. It seems to me that if they can sit there and say that I really want to have this volition, like a second order thing, then they must already have that volition. In fact, it might be that they're picking it up from maybe something they sense is a more mature or profound part of their personality, and they're simply seeking to integrate parts of their personality. It seems like they've already got that volition.
I like that. I think that's good. And the question then comes up, and one that the philosophers address with tremendous energy. What about action? We were talking about Sartre earlier. You know, man is the sum of his actions and nothing more. Well, how do we make the decision about right action? Now you can bring in Eastern philosophy and the Buddhist concept of right action. Again, things begin to come together. And I think you're pointing to exactly what the phenomenon is like inside our own experience. I do experience the first order volition. I want to have the will that I don't have. And say what you said about integration again. That was really good.
Well, just it seems to me like a person can sit there and say, I want to have this will. Maybe I don't have it yet, but I want to have it.
Right.
It seems to me like they really already have it. They just might not have integrated into their active life so much. They're tapping into maybe a more mature and higher side of their personality as they perceive it, and are simply trying to integrate those
parts. Nice. Right. Yeah, I think that's good.
It is sort of like saying I should go this way, but it's not out of outside programming.
That's right.
It's more like a very deep-seated heart desire, as opposed to the surface impulses that they tend to act on most of the time.
Right. Yeah, that's good. I can't improve on that. That's good. Yes.
Do you notice or recognize that in ancient literature, mainly the Bible, the heart is used as a term for will and love, intrinsic love, and what you say reinforces things like God looks upon the heart.
Yeah.
And one of the things which I noticed is the choice of words when it says, the fool has said in his heart there is no God.
Yeah.
Not, he listened to the wrong theological school.
Right.
You know, but in his heart.
You must love the Gospel of John.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. These kinds of notions, to my great surprise, actually deepen most people's appreciation of sacred traditions. I'm most familiar with Christianity because that's the culture I grew up in. But if you start fiddling with this kind of stuff we're talking about tonight, it completely changes your reading of the Bible you grew up with in many, many ways, so that you see that the verses we memorized when we were kids, God is love, or what is the greatest commandment? Love God with all your heart. And the second commandment is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. Paul's letter to the Romans, do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed through the renewal of your mind. Now, we have to remember all of these beautiful King James translations are translations. So when we go back to the original Hebrew or the original Aramaic, in some ways they're even, I don't read any of those languages, but when you parse them, they're even more beautiful than that, because the words have deeper meanings. The word ruach, for example, in Old Testament writing, doesn't just mean spirit, it means wind, and it means breath. And so Jesus comes back to the disciples at Pentecost and says, don't be afraid. And the next line is, and he breathed on them. So that notion of breath and that notion of life and that notion of love all ties together scripturally. It really...
Also, Paul has a thing where he reports what you said about second art. He said, I have what I want to do, what I actually do,
yeah.
And what I actually do is different from what I want.
Yeah, it's in the 8th chapter of Romans. It's one of my favorite verses. I have left undone those things I ought to have done, and I have done those things I ought not to have done, O wretched man that I am.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more.
I'll see y'all in church on Sunday.
I'll be, baby.
They heal. Just they heal them.
We have time for one more question. The gentleman in the back.
As a good atheist, and I've benefited from counseling twice in my life.
You're one ahead of most people.
Both times, I just picked a name out of a house care book that was close.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, how important is it? Now, I would seek somebody who had the same philosophical base that I have, and I don't know how I do that. I go to websites, or I'd ask them some questions before I... How important is that somebody seek out a counselor who was of the same base or psychologists think it's not important?
I can give you a straight answer to that. It depends on what you're looking for help for. And Kevin Major's going to have to write me a check for all the business I've sent him tonight. Kevin made this point when he was talking about Aristotle and cognitive behavioral therapy and some of the discoveries he has made in his own practice. We were comparing notes as we sometimes do. And the point he made, I think, is the direct answer to your question. There are specific kinds of problems that have very simple, straightforward solutions. The fear of speaking to a group is what is technically classified as a phobia or a social phobia. And there are techniques and practices that can solve that problem. The problem of biological depression that's related to neurotransmitters like serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine sometimes really can be solved with a 150 milligram dose of Wellbutrin or Zoloft, because it's a very specific problem, just like a bacterial infection and a pneumonia is caused by bad bugs that antibiotics will kill. So my answer, and I hope this is really straight, is that if the problem is definable in those terms, finding the counselor or therapist or psychiatrist who knows how to work on that, the way Kevin specializes in working on anxiety, for example, or other clinicians work on, I work on addictions. That's my subspecialty. I can be very very helpful, because what you get is just like if you're driving a Toyota and the brakes don't work. You know, we hope there's not an app for that, but we hope there's a fix for that. See what I'm saying? And so that's how I would answer that question. Now folks do come sometimes, and Whitaker, the professor at Wisconsin, used to say that people come to therapy at various points. Some people come in and say, I can't do it, there's nothing I can do, and there's nothing you can do to help me. And he would usually agree, and that was about the end of that. Then he would say, people sometimes come in and say, I can't do it, but you can do it for me. And that's the starting point. And then sometimes people come in and say, I can't do it, I might be able to do it, can you show me how to do it? And then he said, what's the most fun is when someone comes in and says, I'm really not growing fast enough. Have you got any ideas about that? And then it's just the long conversation about life itself. I think it's really important for folks who love these kinds of conversations when we're in a professional role not to seduce people into the long conversation when that's not why they came and that's really not what they're asking for. And it's not up to me to say that's what they need. See what I'm saying? So sometimes somebody comes and they've got a problem and I say, well, okay, can you come next week? And then about 4 weeks later, I think you're going to be fine. And that gets back into the responsibility we all have to do the right thing for the right reason. Not to seduce someone else into our fantasy about what really ought to be important to them. Does this make sense?
Let's give another round of applause for Dr. Thank you.